welcome to this episode of Stories of Hope by Kangaroo Minds. I'm Vedika, and today we have with us author and eating disorder campaigner Zoe Burnett. Zoe is a mental health warrior and has battled atypical anorexia. She is an international public speaker who urges people to not suffer in silence. With her own experiences, her journey, and more recently, her book, Zoe is a strong advocate for set point theory, rebelling against diet culture, proving people to be authentic, and in her own words, because she believes that life is too short for self-hatred and to count your celery sticks. So before we begin our conversation with Zoe today, we're going to give a little trigger warning for our audience. If at any point through this discussion, should you find yourself feeling distressed or triggered, please take a step back to look after yourself. If you need any additional resources, you can also find them on our website. So welcome, Zoe, to our episode, and thank you for joining us. And congratulations on the release of your new book, which has already sold out, I believe, in the first round.
It feels like a dream. It feels surreal. You know, for somebody that was told that I didn't have a voice, I don't deserve a voice, no one's going to listen to you, to have this book that reached number four, you know, in its category on Amazon bestsellers chart, and to have a TEDx talk and to be able to do this, I can't describe that feeling. It's that I do have a voice and I'm going to use it. So you thank you so much for allowing me to have a voice and inviting me on today. Thank you.
No, you absolutely
it's have It's certainly a been a... I'm learning that. It's certainly been a very interesting few years, if you like, since I've been in recovery for atypical anorexia. I said this morning actually that I've not rediscovered who I was, but I've actually discovered all that I'm meant to be in recovery, if that makes sense. Because throughout my whole life I've been trying to conform and morph into what everyone else wants me to be, trying to be this perfect version for somebody else, and I had no idea who I was. And going through this recovery process, I've kind of discovered bits of my personality that I've been trying to suppress. I've discovered who I truly am and all that I'm actually meant to be. And the journey has been phenomenal. I know that sounds really cheesy, but I've really enjoyed learning who I am. I've really enjoyed exploring my personality, and it's been, certainly a roller coaster.
Ravina, you've come such a long way, and I'm sure our viewers would love to know, you know, your story. I mean, I know you wrote about it in your book, but if you want to share your story and, you know, what you've learned and what it's been like.
Of course. I'll briefly summarise my story. If you want to know more, you have to go buy my book. Available on Amazon. Stop it, sorry. But long story short, I was in a very abusive relationship when I was a teenager. It left me fearing for my life on more than one occasion. And I developed post-traumatic stress syndrome as a result of this relationship. However, I was also bullied incredibly badly. I say this all the time. To be fair, I played a flute. Hormones made me very spotty. I wore braces. I had glasses. And I was a goth. So I would have bullied me. But, you know. So I had all of these negative influences in my life. That's when I started to suppress who I was and hide the real me. But also I was taught that it was a weakness to cry. You can't show emotion. You have to be the strong woman and take everything in your stride, which wasn't great for me. Because all that did was, after all the bullying and that traumatic relationship, is I couldn't feel anything. I couldn't feel my emotions. I completely lost touch with them. And I used the eating disorder as a way to deal with those emotions because I didn't know how to deal with them, if that makes sense. So I turned to controlling my food and controlling my weight and shape as a way to control what was actually going on in the world around me. However, it didn't work out too great for me. I ended up resorting back to eating disorder ways every time my life felt out of control. Every time I was faced with a new trauma, every time my PTSD would kick up, I would turn to the eating disorder as a way to cope. However, all I was doing was adding to a balloon, if you like. And every time I did use that eating disorder, every time I emotionally avoided a situation, every time I engaged in unhealthy coping strategies, maladaptive coping strategies, I just added to this balloon until eventually it popped. And what happened was, this time when I turned to eating disorders as a way to cope, I crashed and burnt. I couldn't go on. And I am so lucky to be here today to share my journey. Because what happened was, even though I was a healthy weight, got a hormone imbalance, certain binge purge cycles as well, meant my weight never got to underweight. So it meant that I looked healthy on the outside. So I never got treatment for my eating disorder until it was nearly too late. And I remember in September 2018, I was told by an A&E doctor that I wouldn't live to see Christmas if I carried on, because my heart was struggling to keep up. But no one could understand why, because on the chart I looked healthy. I was healthy according to that BMI chart. So it can't be an eating disorder. But it was. So I'm here to spread a message of hope. Just to say you don't have to fit the stereotype to have an eating disorder. Eating disorders do not care who you are. They do not discriminate. Race, gender, size, doesn't matter to an eating disorder. We have this image in our head of what an eating disorder looks like. And stereotypically, it is, you know, the young, thin, white, teenage woman. And I just want to get hold of that stereotype and chuck it out the window. Because it is so inaccurate. And it stops people seeking that help. It stops me getting help, because I had that stereotypical image in my head of what that eating disorder looked like, and I was like, I don't look ill, I don't look like I've got an eating disorder, when in fact my days were very much ruled around food, weight and shape. Like I said, emotional regulation, I was severely depressed, I couldn't feel anything. I deserved help, and everyone does. But I was very fortunate to finally enter treatment and get help for this once and for all. The journey to recovery has been hard at times, but I'm so thankful that I was finally believed and listened to and finally got that help that I desperately needed.
I think, you know, I'm really glad that, you know, you were able to get the help. And it's really unfortunate, as you said, that, you know, how the stereotype around weight and around BMI sort of, you know, plays in when it comes to people getting help or being diagnosed, because you look fine on the outside, per se, but, you know, it's internally that you know how much you're struggling.
Exactly. And I always say, so I've always said to everyone, eating disorders, yes, they have physical symptoms. Yes, you can, but you can't see what's going on inside my brain. You cannot see that. You cannot see the constant torment that I was under. You cannot see how much I was pulling myself down every opportunity I got. You can't see what's happening inside someone's mind. So how can you tell if someone's got an eating disorder? You can't. And that's for the BMI chart. Tangent, I apologise now. I've recently discovered that the BMI chart was actually invented by a statistician. Not even a doctor, a statistician over 200 years ago. Why in modern day medicine are we using a chart that is over 200 years old, when I'm pretty sure 200 years ago we're still using leeches and cocaine to treat certain illnesses? Surely there's got to be a better way of measuring someone's health than this outdated chart that again doesn't take into consideration that everyone's different. And surely that should be celebrated, that everyone's different. And we shouldn't all fit into one chart, because how boring would life be if we all looked exactly the same? Yeah, I'm not a big fan of the BMI chart, to be honest.
See, another thing that, you know, you advocate a lot is about the set point theory. So do you want to tell us a little bit about it, you know, for our viewers? Because I believe that's been a huge part of your sort of, you know, journey as well, right? In terms of recognizing what you were going through and getting help.
Set point theory pretty much saved my life, to be honest, when I learned about it, because it's the science behind why 95 to 98% of these fad diets fail. And it's why I got stuck in this cruel eating disorder loop, if you like. Basically, set point theory explains that we have a predetermined genetic weight, a bit like our height and our shoe size. We can't change that, can we? I would love to have slightly smaller feet, but I can't physically change it. It's not going to happen, Zoe. But same with our weight. If you imagine your set point is like a little ball, if you like, here. When we engage in these fad diets, when we starve our body and don't fuel it properly, or when we try and get our weights below our set point, our bodies don't like it. And it will start to rebel. You'll notice your metabolism slowing down. You feel more sluggish. You'll feel cold as your body's trying to preserve energy to bring you back up to your set point. But also you become preoccupied with food. You can't stop thinking about food. The chocolate that you've denied yourself time after time again because it's bad or whatever, you can't stop thinking about it. And you your whole world becomes preoccupied with that food because, again, mentally, your body's trying everything to bring you back up to where it needs to be at. But the same does happen, you know, when we overeat. And I always use Christmas as an example because I live on a diet of red wine and cheese at Christmas. I just do. But I gain weight at Christmas. I'm going to. It's part of life, I believe. It's normal. But I know in January, naturally, my metabolism will speed up. My hunger signals slow down. And naturally, that weight comes back down on its own. Because by January, I've about had enough of cheese. In fact, I look like a giant block of cheese. So naturally, I'm craving different foods. If I listen to what my body is telling me and eat intuitively, naturally, my diet adjusts anyway without me doing anything. And my weight comes back down to its set point. I hope that makes sense. Yeah. But it explains why we get stuck in a diet circle, if you like. Because for me, I couldn't accept my set point. I didn't want to be the size. I wanted to be down here, but it's not going to happen because genetics and medications that I was on, and there's so many, you know, elements that make up your set point weight. It's not just what you eat and things like that. It's so much more complex. But I didn't want to accept my set point. So what would happen is I'd engage in dietary behaviours, go below my set point, but then eventually when I come off that diet or when I start to eat a little bit more intuitively, I put the weight straight back on. And then I'd think, oh my God, I need to go on a diet. So I'd go on a diet, engage in compensatory behaviours, and then I put the weight back on. It wasn't me failing the diet, but the diet failing me. Because it's not going to work, because genetically my body doesn't want to be here and it doesn't function. When I went below my set point as well, I was having hormone problems, I was having heart problems, my muscles were weak, my body wasn't healthy, but according to that BMI chart, I was healthy. It wasn't healthy for me. My set point doesn't sit in that healthy category. And I'll openly admit, for me, it does sit high up in the overweight bit, but my body is healthy. I am well. I function. And I'm not preoccupied with food and weight. Ever since I've just accepted my set point, accepted that this is where my body needs to be at, all those preoccupation with food, all of those eating sort of behaviours has slowly fizzled away. It's hard accepting a set point, of course it is. But what choice, you know, what choice did I have? I can either keep going round and round in this, you know, yo-yo dieting, not living my life, scared to go out and enjoy myself with friends, scared of what that Dunnewater scale might tell me. Or accept my set point, accept that, okay, this is who I am, this is who I am, embrace that and live my life. It's not hard, it's not easy, sorry, to pick option two, but you know, it's, if you want to live your life free, then it is the only way. Accept your set point, accept that we are all different shapes and sizes. And isn't that amazing? Because again, life would be boring if we did all look the same.
Absolutely. And I think that'll also explain what a lot of people are going through right now with, you know, COVID and lockdown, right? Like, we are seeing a rise, significant rise in cases of eating disorders. And it's probably because, you know, being at home, people, and like, you know, being stressed out, people are turning to food. But then just as you said, like, as you move a little ahead of, you know, your set point, you start feeling that discomfort. And then it's kind of bringing them into like those fad diets. And you're not.
Yeah, I said to someone the other day, because they was saying that they've gained weight for a knockdown and oh my God. And I was like, and you survived a global pandemic, mate. If the worst thing that's happened is gain weight, think yourself lucky. And I mean this in the nicest way possible, please. Absolutely. Forgive me. But I was like, you know, there's people that's died, there's people that's lost loved ones, there's people that's lost their jobs. And if all that's happened to you is you gained a bit of weight, then thank your lucky stars. Gaining weight, it doesn't matter. Your body has just survived a global pandemic. You have just survived a global pandemic. So what if you gained a bit of weight? It's not the end of the world. You know, being bigger isn't the end of the world. It's really not.
So what would you say, like, for example, you know, like you mentioned that, you know, bullying and, you know, that also the whole idea around being your authentic self. So how important do you think that's been in your journey of, like, recovering?
So important. Like I said at the beginning, I was so desperate to try and fit in because I was bullied. I was so desperate to try and fit in with people when I was growing up. I would change who I was to try and fit in with them. Apart from the problem was, is I didn't fit in with them for a reason. Does that make sense? There's a reason I didn't necessarily get on with these group of people. I was trying to fit in with the wrong groups of people. I was trying to change who I was to please them. And by doing that, I lost who I was and I didn't know who I was. So throughout recovery, I've kind of stuck to it a bit and gone, nope, this is who I am. I'm going to embrace this and see what happens. And I can't describe how thankful I was that I did that, because now I've met, if you like, my fellow tribe of weirdos, who I love dearly, fellow tribe of warriors and people that don't necessarily fit the social norms, but I don't have to be anyone else for them. I can be myself, and I can't describe that pressure that it takes off me, because I'm not masking. I'm not anxious around them. I don't have to pretend to be someone else. I'm not thinking, oh my God, I'm too much. I've said the right thing. I've said the wrong thing. Should I be saying this? I can literally just be who I want. These gorgeous people accept that. And it's just taken that pressure off, not having to mask. Because I do have ADHD as well. So if I can feel myself just gone off, I can just say, oh, sorry about that, guys. And it doesn't matter. I don't feel embarrassed about it. I don't feel like I need to apologize, because it's just who I am. Yeah, just be yourself and you will find the right people, instead of trying to morph into somebody else to please people that, why?
Do you think, like, you know, there were some things which, you know, when you started talking to people about what you were going through and even through your journey of getting help and being in recovery, like, you know, do you think there were things which people told you which, you know, you found helpful, and some things which were not helpful? Because, again, like, sometimes, you know, people don't know what to say and they may just end up saying something. It may not be from a bad place, but it's just not helpful. So, like, you know, if people can know what helps, what doesn't help, I think.
First thing that does not help is suggesting different diets to me. No, because people are, you just try to lose weight. It's just a diet. Go on, do this diet instead. It's like, no, absolutely not. And I just still find myself getting quite frustrated with people that do this, because people still do it. It's like, and I just kind of go off on my high horse about set point theory to these poor people now. But I'm trying to step away from diet culture. I don't want to learn about new diets. Thank you very much. But one thing that is really helpful, it's just, I was reminded, I have the most amazing friends, and one of them just kept reminding me that they loved me regardless, because I felt so unlovable during this whole journey. I hit rock bottom and then discovered I had a basement. I was adamant that I was the world's most vile person for having this illness, and I was just a waste of space. But having those friends in my corner just going, no, we love you. We are here. And she openly admitted one day she doesn't know what to say, but she can listen. That's all you need to do. Just listen. At the time, I didn't understand it. So how do I expect other people to understand what I was going through if I couldn't even explain it myself? So just being there and just listening. You don't have to have the answers. Just being there and reminding your loved one that you still love them. And you're not going anywhere, and you're not going to leave.
I think that's, you know, as you said, really important, just letting people know that, you know, you can provide them that safe space and holding space for them, like, as they go through what they're going through. Like, it's not about fixing. It's not about having solutions. Sometimes you don't even have to know what to say. But definitely, I think, you know, commenting on people's weight tends to come very naturally to people. Like, even in social situations, we do tend to comment. Like, a lot of conversations revolve around food, revolve around weight. So, do you want to, like, and if you want to throw some light on, you know?
Yes, weirdly, you should bring that up actually, because when I started to become a little bit more open about eating disorder, people realised that they'd been complimenting an illness, but they didn't quite know how to react to that. But interestingly enough, I also knew someone that, oh, bless their hearts, they were struggling with cancer, and they was also being complimented for weight loss. And I remember speaking to someone then, I was like, when did it become normal for people just, you don't know what's going on in someone's life. For me, I was being complimented for slowly killing myself. And for my friends, they was being complimented for having an illness. And we was just sat there like, why? This is so wrong. You never know. And also, I had another friend who lost quite a significant amount of weight, bless her heart, when her mum passed away. I refuse to comment on people's weight loss. If I've noticed someone lost weight dramatically, I will ask them if they are okay. How are you, really? Is there anything that we need to be aware of? Is there anything that we can do? Is there something else going on? Always question it, because you never know what that individual could be dealing with.
I mean, is there something that, you know, Zoe, you know now, which you wish you had known earlier? That's it.
Set point theory. My whole life would be probably completely different, and how strange I've only just learned about it now. If I'd known about, you know, that we are genetically designed to be a set weight, and if I'd known about all this sooner, then perhaps I wouldn't have necessarily developed the eating disorder. But, you know, things happen for a reason. So, yeah. Also, I wish I'd have known. It sounds cheesy, forgive me, but I wish I'd known that it was okay to cry. It was okay to show emotion. It was actually a good thing to release that emotions and not try and bury it, get on with it, so to speak. If I'd learnt about healthy emotional regulation at a younger age, it would have equipped me a lot better later on in life, if that makes sense. It's okay to show emotion. It's okay to cry. It's not a weakness. If anything, it's an act of bravery, because you are showing you can let out those emotions, and that is the strongest thing that you can do.
I think, you know, you have that point that, you know, somehow we feel that showing emotion makes us vulnerable. And again, like, you know, going back to what you previously said, just having people around you who can be supportive and hold that space can make other people feel a little less like afraid of showing emotions as well, because sometimes you just don't know how people around you are going to react. Like, are you going to, you know, scare them away, or are you going to alienate them, or are you going to, you know, are they not going to feel comfortable all of a sudden, like, you know, around you when you're in that state?
I always say to people, I'm so sorry, you're not in charge of how anyone else feels. You're only in charge with your own emotions. And if crying and releasing that emotion is good for you, then brilliant. If someone else has a problem with you crying, then that is their issue, not yours. Does that make sense? I hope that makes sense.
It does.
So, yeah, so if someone feels, oh, you're crying, get away from me, then they've clearly got a little bit of work to do themselves as well. You know, but yeah, that's their issue, not yours. You need to do what's right for you. And if letting that emotion out, letting it just out in that way is good for you, then that should be the end of the story, because you are the most important person. You've got to look after number one.
I think that's, you know, that's true. Like, just putting yourself first, putting your mental health first, I feel like that's something we've always been told, you know, growing up, that, oh, it's selfish. Like, you know, think about other people. And then suddenly you come to this whole mental health context and you're like, actually, it's not selfish to prioritize yourself.
Jesus. How can you look after everyone else if you're exhausted? How can you give so much to other people when you're running on empty yourself? I always say to like fellow mental health advocates, because it can be quite exhausting sometimes, like you have to look after yourself, because how are you supposed to advocate for change? How can you do your job when you are absolutely exhausted? You're not giving it your best then. I know by taking a little bit of time out, a little bit of self-care, pressing that reset button almost, that every interview, every piece of work that I do, I know I can give 100% because I'm able to, because I'm charged and I'm ready, if that makes sense. There's a famous phrase, isn't there, that you can't pour from an empty jug. True. And I'm such a big believer in that. But also, going back to self-care, I truly believe that I was doing self-care wrong at one point, because self-care looks so different for everybody.
Yeah.
And so many times I was told just to go sit in a bath. And I mentioned earlier, I've got ADHD. So if I'm sat in a bath, I'm thinking, oh, I wonder if, I don't know, if cows can swim. Oh, they can, by the way. I Googled it. But I start thinking about all these different weird and wonderful, because I can't just switch off. I can't just sit in the bath and switch off. So I thought that I was wrong because I can't do self-care. When actually I wasn't doing what was right for me. What works for me is music. I am a musician. I play the flute. So for me, my self-care is getting my flute out, playing, because then I'm using my ears. I've got to focus on the music in front of me. I'm grounding myself to the root of the floor because I'm stood, I'm postured. It just involves all of those senses. So it just helps me calm. So there is no right or wrong way to do self-care. You know, it really is a journey and trying to discover what works for you personally. And never be embarrassed if what should be working doesn't. It is just about what works for you and go with it.
I think that's, you know, like, as you said, like, sometimes also social media creates very false perceptions of what self-care should be. So sometimes...
It's all bath bombs and face masks. And like I said, I can't do it. I can't sit. I can't physically do it. It doesn't work. But yeah, it does make you feel really... Am I wrong? Because it's not working for me. It does make you feel really awkward in a way.
And like, for instance, like shopping, or, you know, some people will be like, oh, you know, go exercise. But if someone has battled an eating disorder, exercise
exactly.
can...
Oh, become... The amount of times I've been told to exercise and eat well to improve your mental well-being. I'm like, pretty sure that's what got me, you know, in this mess in the first place. No, thank you. Yes, obviously exercise can be good for your mental well-being, but how are you exercising? That's what I always ask anyone. Are you doing it to feel good? Are you exercising as a celebration of what your body can do? Or are you exercising as punishment for what you ate? How are you using exercise? Because one is amazing, yes, feel good, and the other can be deadly. So I always encourage people to have a really close look at why they are exercising and evaluate what they are doing.
I think that's where, you know, like, a lot of things are such a fine line, right? Like, you know, between just knowing that, you know, you're okay versus you're not okay, or are you exercising as a means of punishment, or is it just like a feel good thing?
It's really hard to know the difference. It is. But in my trainers over there, you can't see them, but on my trainers, I've actually got a little flashcard in my trainer that says, stop. Is this compensatory behavior or to feel good? And the fact I've got to like take that card out of my trainers to go, oh, hang on, am I compensating here? Am I trying to burn off what I eat? You know, punish myself for basic human rights, you know, eating? Or, oh, am I doing this to feel good, to have fun and enjoy what I'm about to do? But the fact I've got to literally pull that out, it makes me read it and it just makes me go, hang on. No, it's for the right reasons. Off I go. Or, hello, Ed. Sorry, Ed's what I call my little eating sort of voice. Hello, Ed. No, I'm doing this to compensate. I'm going to put them back and go sit on the sofa because I'm not going to listen to you today. It does make me question it.
I think that can be really empowering as well. Like, just knowing, right? Like, which path are you going down? And you know, having you share your story today, share your experiences. I think we've covered so many different aspects of eating disorders and what you went through. I think, like, you know, I think for a lot of people, just knowing that they're not alone in what they're going through, because again, like, that's one thing about mental health, it makes you feel extremely isolated from everyone.
It does, and eating disorders thrive in isolation, which is why there has been such a big rise during the pandemic. It's like it doesn't want you to share it with anyone. It's, you know, it tries to keep you trapped by keeping you closed off to everyone else, if that makes sense. But it's, I felt so alone because obviously I was in a larger body when I had atypical anorexia. I didn't fit the stereotype. So I felt so alone on this journey, so alone. But recently there's a statistic that's just come out that states that only 6% of people with an eating disorder are actually underweight. And I wish I'd known that when I first started struggling, because I often felt like the recovery spaces and things online, I thought, oh, they won't accept me because I don't look, I don't fit the stereotype. I'm not going to be accepted. I'm not going to be believed. I'm not going to be listened to. When actually I couldn't have been further from the truth. There are the most amazing people out there that your cheerleaders. I love this phrase, forgive me. But you know, the people that cheer you on, the people that want you to succeed, the people that are fighting this disorder with you. And yes, social media can be a double-edged sword, I guess, because on some ways it can be dangerous. You know, you click on the wrong hashtags, you've fallen down a rabbit hole. Algorithms, if you like a personal trainer, you know, social media algorithms will then suggest more like that. And before you know it, you've fallen down a very dangerous rabbit hole. But then on the other side, there are the recovery advocates that I follow that make me feel so empowered. There are people fighting and sharing their recovery experience loudly so people don't struggle in silence. Find those people that are fully recovered as well, and that share their journey. And you are not alone in this. Please never feel alone.
I think on that note, Zoe, I'm going to ask you, I think, my last question, and then leave it to you if there's anything else you want to add. But if you could give one piece of advice to anyone, you know, who's watching this today, who's having a hard time with their mental health, what would that be?
Oh, hang in there. I know it sounds really cheesy, but just hang in there. You never know what's around the corner. I said earlier, I'm just going to use myself as an example. 2 years ago, forgive me, 2 years ago, I was in a crisis house. I couldn't even keep myself alive. I didn't want to be here. I was adamant the world would be a much better place without me. 2 years later, I'm an international public speaker, a best-selling author, a musician, a surfer, a wife and a mother. Never in a million years did I believe that I would be worthy or capable of any of these amazing things. But recovery from any mental illness, you know, not just eating disorders, it is possible. With, you know, reach out, I'm aware that services are overstretched at the minute and are severely underfunded, but still, you know, try, give them a go. Charities, reach out, find your cheerleaders, find the people that want to support you and talk. Get those conversations going. Because you're not alone in this, and recovery is possible. And my goodness, recovery is worth it.
I think that's been really, really enriching. And I think you sort of summed up the entire essence of, you know, having this space called, like, you know, Stories of Hope. So thank you, Zoe, for being here, for joining us, and for everything that you do as a mental health campaigner, an eating disorder activist. You know, like, you are holding space for so many people, and we're glad we had you today to join us and share your story. I know a lot of people who are going to watch this will feel, you know, that sense of like being a little less alone, that, you know, yes, someone's been through it. There is like a relatability factor, but at the same time, like, just knowing that it gets better, like, there is hope out there. And it's not something which, you know, people are just telling you just to keep you going, but it's actually possible to recover. And
it's so hard because when you're in that frame of mind, and when you, like I said earlier, when you have kind of hit that rock bottom and then discovered a basement, and you can't see that things will get better. And it's so hard to see when you are in that moment. And I'm not going to lie, it doesn't happen overnight. It doesn't. And I'm so sorry. It does take a lot of work, and it does take a lot of energy. But again, the results, going on that journey of self-discovery, discovering all that you're meant to be and finding those new passions, and it is so rewarding. It doesn't happen overnight, unfortunately, but hang in there, because it does get better. It does.
So So for everyone watching this, if you're having a hard time with your mental health, just know that, you know, it will get better and there is help out there. There is somebody out there who cares about you. So just reach out and know that, you know, there is hope, there is help, and you will heal from whatever you're going through. So till
HOPE even stands for Hold On, Pain Ends. It's like a little acronym. If that makes
sense. That is absolutely beautiful, I think, you know, to look at it that way. So yeah, absolutely. Just know that, you know, I mean, it may seem dark right now, but it will get better. So, till next time, please stay well and stay healthy. Thank you.